right, folks, welcome back to the Flagstaff.com Teacup Podcast, brought to you this week by TaylorMade and the Tour Response Golf Ball. My name is Stefan Tudorf, sitting with my co-host, Scott Cloud. How are you today, Scotty?
You know what? I've got nothing to complain about. How's that?
I think that's...
How's that for a start?
Well, I think it's fair. I think it's recognizing a lot that's going on in the world right now, and there are some people that have some things to complain about right now, and I think we'd be remiss not to start right there and start on a super heavy topic, but one I think, you know, we have a platform to talk about, you know, everything golf and, you know, everything that's going on in the world. And here's something that I feel is, it's not easy to talk about, and, you know, recognizing as two white men, it's probably, it's touchy to talk about. We, you know, we don't know what we should say, right? And I think the key here is, though, let's learn together and actually start speaking about things. And obviously, if you haven't picked up on it yet, we are talking about the protesting going on in the States over the death of George Floyd. And I think, you know, you and I were going back and forth a little bit over text about this and how, you know, it's not this, these things don't just happen in the States. No. They happen all over the world. You know, we are obviously in Canada and we've seen it before, and they happen in golf too. And golf, I think, needs to be better. And there's been racism in golf forever, right? If we look back at it, if you've read anything about Tiger Woods in the past, you know, he wasn't allowed to play at certain golf courses because he was black. And, you know, it's tough. And we are lucky we don't have never had to experience that ourselves. But I'm sure, you know, firsthand and through stories, we've seen it and heard it. And it's never something we want to see or hear.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think the biggest thing that I learned early on about the topic was listen more and tell less, because, you know, we've never had that experience. We, you know, a lot of people who are, you know, white that have never experienced the racism that a lot of other people have tend to talk about it in a first person sense of it. And really, in the end, we're just observers. We don't know what's going on. Certainly seen a lot of these things. And golf, you know, like you said, we've talked about it, had things touched on in our lives. I mean, my family's a rainbow. You know, I've got people of every background in my family. So, you know, just discussing things with them, whether it's cousins or nieces and nephews who are indigenous, there's a lot of things. But really, it's about listening and hearing and also acting as well to be better. And certainly golf is not immune. Things have happened a long time. You just have to go back and, you know, you can look at Charlie Sifford's book, Just Let Me Play. I mean, it's a good read if somebody goes, and you can see what he went through to play professional golf. And, you know, it's just a taste of what's happened in our sport. And you know, so we're guilty too. Our sport is guilty. Our sport needs to be better. The whole world needs to be better. And, you know, touchy as the subject is, it has to be talked about. And if you don't talk about it, then nothing is going to get better.
Well, you touched on acting, you know, and not just, you know, retweeting things, but actually acting. And prior to going on here, I did some quick research of the big names in our sport right now. I'm not going to call them out by name, but you can go and do your own research, and nothing has been said by any of them. Which, you know, when times are easy, when it's easy to support things, when it's easy to throw money at things, you know, because it's good publicity, you know, it happens, and they will. But here we are, where you can't just throw money at a problem, right? And it's telling to me. And, you know, over the last couple of days, it took me a long time to just reflect on my life. And one of the first things that really hit me was on Twitter, I saw something that said, "Who was your first black teacher?"
I saw you talk about
so
that. Yeah.
I sat there and I went through all my elementary school days and all my high school days. And I went to university 20 years of my life before I had a black teacher.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if we look at it from a boss perspective, same thing. I never reported to, you know, from a working relationship to a black person. And now I got thinking about today in golf. And I thought, when was the last time I walked into a pro shop and behind the counter, the pro stand there was black? Or I got paired up with a group, and I got paired up with somebody that was black, and I can't think of it. And that's a problem. And one of the main problems is, A, if you go back in the history, you know, it hasn't been an inclusive game. It never has been. And let's be honest, is it really still an inclusive game?
No, it's exclusive. It's there to keep people out. We've talked about that before. And you know, that's continued. Has it gotten better? Maybe slightly, but not, it's certainly not great. It's certainly not reflective of society.
No, absolutely. And when you, you know, if we look at something like Augusta National, the place we all hold near and dear to our hearts and on, put on this pedestal, they didn't let black members until 1990.
Yeah.
It's embarrassing. And what that does is it means that people, you know, black kids are watching TV and they throw on golf and they don't see anybody that looks like them other than Tiger Woods, which, yes, when you watch TV and Tiger's playing, you're going to see his shots more than anybody else. But when it's 159-1 in a, in a tournament, we probably have a problem, and we probably aren't growing the game in everywhere and actually being inclusive. And I think it's good time for everyone to reflect, and maybe, you know, we have a lot of pros that listen to this podcast, and whether they're, you know, working in the shop or, you know, they run a driving range or whatever. And I would just encourage them is, you know, maybe give that kid that applied to your shop that might not have the same experience, but has that diverse background, give them a shot and show them and allow them to teach you something, right? Because maybe they don't have the background in your industry, but they have a background in something else you don't know about. And until you actually work with them, you'll never know about it. So I hope, you know, we encourage people and we actually have these conversations, these difficult conversations, and actually start moving to a place where golf is more diverse. And it's not just Tiger Woods when you think of the black players out there. And yes, there are more. And shout out to Harold Varner, who had some great things to say on Twitter today as well.
Yeah, I saw that.
But it shouldn't just be numbers on one hand.
No, not at all. It really shouldn't be. And I mean, you know, we're recording this. It's June 1st, the start of Pride Month as well. So, you know, people have to take that into account as well. I mean, you know, we can do a lot more. And, you know, we're reflected really talking about our own experiences. And again, you know, it's not about us, but, you know, I can still recall a friend. And when I was 13, I was at a junior high school in Dartmouth. And I didn't really know much about Dartmouth when I moved there. And I lived in a place called Ross Road. And I didn't realize that it was a predominantly black community that was nearby. And I was like, wow, you know, and it took a friend of mine to start talking to me about what his grandparents had gone through in Halifax. And I'd like to encourage people really to go. And I went back and looked at this the other day. I've looked at the film before. The National Film Board has got a great film. It's 30 minutes plus on Africville, which is the predominantly black community that was in Halifax, that was there and established in 1785. And unfortunately, the government in the 1960s basically systematically pushed everybody out of that community into another community. And really, like we say, this just doesn't happen in the U.S. It happens around the world. It happens within our own borders. And I think we have to educate ourselves, recognize that that happens, whether it's those communities, like I said, indigenous communities, urban communities, you name it. And just don't pretend it's not happening. Recognize it. If you can do something about it, do something about it. And, you know, just be better.
I agree. I challenge people to, you know, invite that your, you know, your black friends to come play golf, because maybe they don't even feel they're welcome there. Right. And that, you know, without even asking, you have no idea.
I had a boss at a golf course, in Kingston here, actually at Bell Park, a guy named Roy Forbes, who was originally from Jamaica. And the cool thing that I got from Roy was he introduced me and told me about the Caribbean Golf Association, which plays in the Ajax Whitby area, the Pickering area. And a few years later, I happened to be up in, I think it was Lake Ridge, and it was really kind of cool. And as you said, it was kind of, you know, different, which it shouldn't be, of going to this golf course and all of a sudden seeing, you know, all these black men and women playing golf. And I thought, you know, that's the way golf should be. It should be everyone. That shouldn't look unusual. Right. You know, you shouldn't walk in there and go, wow, what's going on here in any possible way. You should just think, okay, just another golfer. That's really about it. But, you know, recognizing that, you know, this is a game that can be inclusive if people choose to be, but the more exclusive that you try and make it, and you try to make it that club, and we've talked about that before, don't make it a club. Don't make it a closed space. Make it an open space as much as you can.
I agree. I don't think there's any more we need to say on it. it's tough. Clearly, I'm almost at a loss for words. It's yeah. emotional. It's and the worst part about it all is it took a death, another death,
another
stat line. You know, another number for this to happen. I'm supporting everyone out there in their quest for equality. And if there's anything we can do with this podcast, please reach out to us and let us know. There's no easy way to transition to the next stuff, and we're going to bring it over to what's happening in the world of golf as well right now, and some good that the PGA Tour is doing right now. So why don't you touch on that, Scotty?
Yeah, so we had news today that, you know, the PGA Tour, which is obviously, you know, most of their news of late has always been about cancellations and different things that are happening with the schedule, obviously a lot COVID-19 related, but they announced that they'd created a PGA University, which is basically a pathway for pro golfer or for golfers to go from college into pro golf. And basically what it's doing is it's rewarding NCAA golfers that have played 4 years. And that's one of the big things here. They don't want people just leaving early, but they're going to provide them some opportunities to make a pathway to the PGA Tour without going to Q School. And basically what they're going to do is they're going to take this ranking list. The top five finishers are going to get access to be exempt for full field events on the Korn Ferry Tour for the next year. And then basically they're also making them exempt to the finals of Q School so they can try to, you know, get full status and get into the other events as well, besides the open ones. And then further down that list, there's going to be created different levels of eligibility for exempt status on the PGA Tour Latino America, Mackenzie PGA Tour Canada, and the PGA Tour Series China as well. You know, obviously it's not going to be a ton of players, but it is a pathway. It's rewarding players that are, you know, finishing out their education. It's another way that they can get access and start their professional career. So good on the PGA Tour for being forward and thinking of that.
Yeah, I think it's really cool that they're actually thinking about the education in this, right? And I think if others, this is, you know, this is a start in a very, in a lot of good ways. I know with the NFL, they tried that to push them to keep, you know, developing, going to school and also developing their bodies, considering, you know, the difference in the bodies and at the football level. Yeah. But this is clearly about education where, you know, a lot of times it's like one and done, just, you know, go out there for the experience and then go to the PGA Tour, go out there for the experience, go to the NBA. So I really like that. I think it's a cool thing and really does give those guys, those seniors that have guys and girls, I would assume that they'll probably do something with the LPGA in the future here.
Yeah, I'm hoping we see something from them as well. I mean, it's just announced PGA Tour so far, but I would imagine that the LPGA Tour will take a swing at this as well.
Yeah, well, either way, I don't see anything. I don't know how you could find a negative thing about this. This is an awesome idea. And, you know, it just encourages people, if you look at it this way, I hope they're talking to them this way. It's like, this is really tough. Get that education. We're going to give you a start in professional golf. And if it doesn't work out, you still have that education. That's the important part. And if the PGA Tour is telling you that, then maybe, you know, it's easy to ignore your parents and be like, oh yeah, whatever, dad, like I'm going to be a golfer. Yeah. But like if the PGA Tour is telling you this, then maybe they'll listen a little bit more.
Yeah. And I think it's a continuing to educate people and make them realize that, you know, the golfer that obviously all of a sudden just jumps out there and becomes, you know, a top part of the game, they're the rarity.
Yeah. The Jordan Spieths like come out of college. It doesn't really happen.
It doesn't really happen. It's really, really rare. So I think what it's doing is it's emphasizing, like you said, the education standpoint. And it very much leans back into what they did when they're changing the Q schools, that it only went to the Korn Ferry Tour versus the PGA Tour, because they found the players that were coming to Q School and, you know, they got their shot, got their card for the PGA Tour. They weren't quite prepared to be on the PGA Tour. So they found they lost their cards sooner versus players that came up through the Korn Ferry Tour, got the experience, or, you know, obviously the tours down below that. This creates a more of a structure for them, basically a better foundation for these players, give them a longer chance for, or a better chance for long-term success. And I think that's important more than just the gamble of go out there, think you're going to take, you know, the world by storm. And then all of a sudden, you know, your dreams are shattered.
Well, yeah, you're going from college, university, 22, maybe when you're done, or if you're younger, 20, whatever it is. And now you're being thrown into, you know, the PGA Tour, which is like the dream forever, right? Now you're there and all your, you know, these people you looked up to are around you. Like, there's a, it's intimidating. It's going to be tough. So let's, I like the idea of giving them, you know, starts on the Korn Ferry Tour and allowing them to get their feet under them. I think it's a much better way. And also, it's a little bit more fair for those guys that are out on the Korn Ferry Tour, right? Like, those guys are grinding out. They're losing, like, they might have limited stats. They're losing starts to some college kid. I think this is just more fair all around for everybody. One thing you did mention in there, you just mentioned the Korn Ferry Tour, and we talked a little bit about it. Just a quick sidebar. You see Vijay pulled out of that Korn Ferry Tour event.
He did. I mean, you know, there was no, there's no reason given at this point. Obviously, a lot of people are speculating why. You know, they think it's because of the criticism or one way or the other. He hasn't commented on it, so I'm not going to speculate on it as far as why he decided not to. There could be a million reasons why he didn't, but
yeah, maybe because there wasn't $1 million on the line.
Well, that could be it. Yeah, but I mean, again, we knew it was in his backyard and he had every right to play in it. But yeah, he's decided to withdraw from it, and I guess, you know, I guess it becomes a moot point as far as anything to talk about. At this point.
I don't think Vijay cares about what anyone said on Twitter. I don't even think Vijay knows what a Twitter is, let alone all that. Like, it just doesn't seem like up his alley. He might have Twitter. Maybe I'm just blind to that.
I don't think he really cares what Brady Schnell thinks.
Yeah,
so.
Probably not. Yeah. You know, he's got his major championships plugging in his ears. He can't hear Brady through them. Also some good going on in the world. Annika is helping out some Metro Tour players. What details do you have around that?
Yeah, so basically through her foundation, the Annika Foundation, they've basically started a crisis relief fund. So they're seeding it with $50,000. And basically what they want to do is they want to support the Symetra Tour players. Now, obviously, it's going to be pretty hard to support a lot of players. But, you know, if they can basically support up to 100 players, it's $500. But, I mean, it's better than nothing as far as to support it. The problem is right now for the Symetra Tours, their season is currently cut down to 12 events as opposed to 20 that they originally had planned. And you got it. We know. I mean, we've had the players on here before. They don't make much money at all.
Let's be honest. They don't make money.
They try
to fight their costs.
Yeah, that's really what it comes down to. And thankfully as well, the LPG Tour also has a cash advance program for the Symetra Tour members. So they can get up to $2,000 and pay it back through money that they win in 2020 and 2021. But, you know, this is a great thing for Annika to do. And I recognize the fact that, you know, there's probably some LPGA Tour players struggling as well. But, you know, Annika has really been about supporting players through her foundation, and to have this crisis fund, that's really, again, giving back. And maybe it's giving hope to some player who was going to bail. You know, they basically looked at it and said, you know what, it's not worth it. It might be the difference. You just never know. And, you know, some people criticize it maybe because they say it's only $500, but $500 is a lot of money if you're playing the Symetra Tour.
Yeah. When you're, you know, you don't know, you know, how you're even getting to the first event, that $500 might get you there and through the week just so you can play. Right. Totally. Like they've all gone back home, right, to their houses. And it's not like you can just pick up a job in the middle of a pandemic. Right. That is their job, you know, and a lot of them even getting out there came from funding from who knows where. Right. And while those people that are funding them might not have, like, there's so much going on. $500 could go a long, long way right now. And, you know, I'm sure there's other ways we can all help those players out on the Symetra Tour. Other news and noteworthy things over the last couple of weeks: the fifth major got canceled, the John Deere Classic. what a shame at TPC Deer Run. I kid. It actually is a shame, but a good positive note I saw out of that all the charity donations they were planning to make are still being done, which is awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I feel bad for them. I mean, they've been a great event as far as supporting the community. This was supposed to be their 50th anniversary. This is the 50th time it was being played. So that'll have to be postponed till next year. But yeah, it's one of the best charities or best tournaments as far as giving to charity. They were over $12 million last year that they gave to the community. In the history of the event, they've donated more than $120 million to the community. So the fact that they are stepping up to make sure that those charities get taken care of like they would be, that's great, because really in the end, that's what it's really about more than anything. It's not about us getting to see, you know, players play another event or anything like that. The fact that the community that benefits the most for these charity events still gets taken care of, that makes it sort of okay. And we can wait till next year.
I agree. Lori Kane finally got her T-Talk bump. She has been named to the Canadian Sports Hall of Fame, 4-time LPGA winner, came on T-Talk. That she'll probably talk about that, I would assume, during her Hall of Fame speech. She's going in with Steve Nash, which is cool. Steve Nash, I mentioned this on a few podcasts ago when we had Doug on. He's my favorite player of all time in the NBA. And yeah, that's got to be cool for Lori.
Yeah, it's a great class. There's 11 of them that are going in, and certainly, you know, Diane Jones, Konnikoski. There's a bunch of great athletes. Certainly, Lori was very tickled by the honor. You know, it's been incredible. I mean, we say her 4 wins, but she had 99 top 10s on the LPGA Tour. And the other side of it, too, for Lori and people that maybe go back and listen to the podcast when she was on, is that she is so community-minded. So this Sports Hall of Fame Award is it's about sports, but it's about her connection to the community as well. And so many of the things that she does as an ambassador for not only Prince Edward Island, for Canada, for CP, for every charity, every company that she gets involved with, she gives everything, and as a result of it, it's well deserved.
Oh yeah, the mayor of PEI, she has
she has pretty much
the whole island. It should just be named after her for at least one day. Though, you know, we went over some positive news, we started off on some tough news and what was going on. We got some other tough news, as the Mackenzie Tour is officially canceled for 2020. There's been a lot of speculation. We obviously had Scott on a few weeks ago, who is the director of the Mackenzie Tour. And, you know, he told us their plans at the time for that. And, you know, we joked about on the podcast, it was a fluid situation, and it continued to be. And obviously, as of this week, they have canceled the season.
Yeah, as he mentioned then, you know, he was on plan 7 of 7 weeks at that point. But, you know, the situation just kept getting more complicated, you know, with the borders still being closed, quarantine periods in place. You know, obviously a lot of the players are from the United States. They would have to quarantine, that sort of thing. Plus, there's a lot of different rules in multiple different jurisdictions. These tournaments are in multiple different provinces, so they'd have to deal with that. It just got too complicated. But thankfully, you know, they're going to tackle it in a way that, you know, it's sort of suspended as far as the tour. They had 3 Q schools. The players that earn status through that will have status for 2021. They'll use the 2019 order of merit to determine eligibility for the year following. And for the players that were intending to go to the Q schools that were still left to take place, they'll be guaranteed spots when the Q school opens up again. So hopefully those players are still playing and they can take advantage of those opportunities. Again, you feel badly for the communities that were hosting these events. Big for them, big for charities in the community, but unfortunately, just the logistics were just too much.
Yeah, well, you touched on the players hopefully still playing by that point, right? Like,
yeah,
I think especially the Canadians, right? If you're in Canada right now, the border's closed, right? You're not getting down to the States to go play in these small tournaments happening in Florida and Arizona, right? The Latino America Tour, I mean, if this tour's canceled, that's not happening anytime soon.
Sure.
The travel there is insane. What are they going to do, right? Like, now you're hoping to play in a bunch of pro-ams around the country, right? Like, I was talking to David Byrne, who we've had on the podcast, and, you know, we joke that, you know, if David Byrne shows up to your pro-am, just hand him the check right away, because he's gonna beat you. But he was super disappointed. He was talking about, you know, I was planning to play the Windsor event and hopefully, you know, go do well there, and then maybe, you know, consider Q school and yada yada yada, and maybe Europe tour Q school. And I was like, well, what are your plan now? I was like, I have no idea.
Yeah.
He threw a couple you know, different choice words in the middle of that, but like, it just it's crazy. And that's what I do wonder, is like, the player that's just so close, what's gonna happen in Canada? And it's unfortunate that there isn't more for them up here, more competitive professional golf.
Yeah, well, what we're going to see is, you know, we had Michael Gligic on last week, and Miles Creighton, who caddies for him, who plays PGA Tour China. You know, he's got some exempt status for, you know, other tours, but he's not in a position to obviously go back to China, do some things with some other tours. So he's going to caddy. David Byrne, you know, you mentioned him. He's going to be coming down and playing in Belleville, the JT Classic, the charity classic down there. Jody Jenkins, who runs that charity tournament in Belleville, this is Belleville, Ontario. I mean, he's had to do a lot of switch up with his players. He had a bunch of American players that were scheduled to come up. He's now have to go, okay, let's go a little bit more homegrown. Thankfully, there's a lot of them around. So he's got some Symetra Tour players playing in there. He's got Canadian Tour players. He's got a little bit of mix of everything. But, you know, those are not events that are really going to sustain these people from an income standpoint. So, you know, unfortunately for a guy like David, he's going to be slinging sushis at the bar still, trying to, you know, basically put himself on hold for another year, which is a difficult thing. And in a lot of cases, as we've said and we've mentioned before, you know, at some point those people are going to go, well, if I have to wait, it might be time to move on to something else. And, you know, they might never, you know, finish out their dreams.
Yeah, who knows? And I think this is a good transition over to our interview this week. We have Josh Whalen on the podcast, local professional in the Kingston area, former number one amateur in Canada. And this was his first year of professional golf, just turned professional late last year, was hoping for a big year, and you know whether it was out of his control, but here we are. So why don't we chat with Josh, see what he's up to, see what his plans are. I'm sure they're ever changing, and see how he gets past all the curveballs thrown his way in his career.
This episode of Tee Talk is brought to you by the all new Tour Response from TaylorMade. Golfers have been yelling at their balls since, well, since always. So TaylorMade decided to make a ball that's designed to maximize performance and minimize shouting with a soft, responsive urethane cover that's surprisingly affordable. So now, just like the pros, you can swear by a urethane ball, but without paying a tour quality price. The all-new Tour Response from TaylorMade. Swear by it, not at it. Visit TaylorMadeGolf.ca to learn more about the all-new Tour Response golf ball.
All right, folks, we'd like to welcome to the podcast local legend. Look at that. Already got a smile on his face from that. Josh Whalen, former number one amateur in Canada and just turned professional this year. What a year to choose that, Josh.
Yeah, certainly. Picked a good one for it.
Well, I mean, it's almost a telltale of your career in many ways, which we'll go over. But how's this year been? You know, I mean, your plan was obviously to go down to Florida and you found a place and that kind of got thrown for a loop. So why don't you give us a quick rundown of what the plans were and how they changed real quick?
Yeah, I was super excited for the year, actually. It kind of came up with a plan, was staying with a buddy down in Tampa, found a spot, Blair Bercy, Canadian. So it was a lot of fair. I got down there, I don't know, January, and we're just outside of Tampa, a spot called Saddlebrook Resort. And we treated really nicely there, practicing at a great facility. Golf courses were pretty good. And the nice thing about where we were located was there's a bunch of tours and tournaments that you could play in. Could go to Orlando and play in some events there. The West Florida Tour had a lot of events, Tampa, just south of Tampa, Sarasota, stuff like that. So was planning to play a bunch of those and was super excited. And then was basically just down there trying to prepare for Q School for the Mackenzie Tour. And obviously things have changed for us, but I don't know, still looking forward to the future and excited about it.
And you've been a guy through your whole career. I mean, you've definitely faced a few things, really from junior all the way up. And I mean, I guess facing, I won't say controversy, but I guess a non-linear path has always been your way. So, you know, that flexibility, do you think that sort of makes you a little bit more adaptable, I guess, to what's happening right now?
Yeah, I feel like I've definitely had, I don't know, sometimes, you know, make a couple steps forward and then take a few more back throughout my career. I'd say junior golf was fairly smooth, but just kind of was like a steady progression. But then had some step backs in college, and then kind of fought my way back and one of the better players, top 50 player or so in the country, and then amateur career then as well. Just after school, and as you mentioned, ended up being number one ranked amateur in Canada at one point, which is a great honor. I got a dog coming in here, though. I might have to get rid of her.
We don't mind a dog in the podcast. Dog friendly.
Yeah, no. I lost my train of thought there, but sometimes get kicked around a little bit and have to step back up on the horse, and I've been good at doing that so far in my career, so I'm not worried about having to sort of go through something again.
Yeah, I mean, one of the hardest parts obviously was, you know, your first year coming out of college, you know, your family were fighting, your girlfriend got cancer, and that threw a big loop for you, and that's probably a vital year for you coming out of school and for your golf, and you put it on pause to you know, be with her and help her with that. And how was that year?
Yeah, that was it was tough. I mean, I had just finished school, and would have been June. We had a great season, a lot of fun. We had like four different guys win on our team, and everyone was just playing super well. It was a ton of fun, and then I went in and had one of my best summers that I'd ever had, playing amateur golf, a lot of good finishes and some big tournaments. Had a chance to win the Canadian Am, had a chance to win the Sonny Hanna Amateur. Just had a really great season, my best season I'd ever had, and one of my goals for the longest time was to get on the national team, and that was as a junior, and I came up just short as a junior. And a couple of years had come up just short as at an amateur too. And then to finally get on there, was super excited, got to travel a little bit. It went to Australia and played in Argentina too. And then was just kind of starting to really get into, a lot of amateur tournaments, cause I was done with school. So there's not really a whole lot of amateur tournaments to play in from, sort of February till everyone's out of school. So I was just kind of gearing up for that. Was down in Florida and Carolinas playing and practicing. And then she wasn't feeling well and ended up being diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia. And she spent about 40 days in the hospital in Kingston. And it was... came at a good time because I didn't have a whole lot of tournaments going on at the moment, and I was able to come home, and it was right at the start of April, so golf courses weren't really open in Canada, so I was able to be there with her during that whole time, and her family was awesome through it. Her mom was her rock through the whole thing. She was unbelievable, and her mom and her family and her Jenny, they wanted me to like get out and still play and practice and stuff like that. And I took a bit of time off from competing and was supposed to go over to England and play in a couple of events with the national team, and decided to stay closer to home and play in a couple of events. And if anything were to come up, would have been able to come home, for her, but definitely changed my year, golf wise, and tried to be home as much as I could and stayed a little bit closer to home.
Well, I think the cool part about it all is Golf Canada really supported you throughout that, and obviously extending your time with the team afterwards. How important was it knowing they had your back through and through?
Yeah, they were awesome. I mean, I think I called Derek Ingram, the national team coach. I was driving back from down south when I had got the news. And I chatted to him, and he said, you know, don't worry or think about golf at the moment, just be there for her and whatnot. And, so he, they were awesome. A lot of other people in the Golf Canada organization were awesome too. And then this past year, she had wanted to do like a charity golf tournament, and Golf Canada donated so many prizes, hats and shirts and lots of stuff to go for silent auction and prizes and stuff like that. So they were unbelievable through the whole thing.
So for you, I mean, you got to play in the RBC Canadian Open last year, and although you missed the cut, and I know that was probably disappointing for you, and we talked to you a little bit up there, but did it seem, you know, even though that you missed the cut, there was still a lot to gain from that appearance up there, because, you know, Jenny was there, you got the to be there, Herb Page obviously getting inducted, there was a lot of Kent State love and things that were going on. You know, what was that week for you? I talked to you a little bit up there, but, you know, it was hard at that point because you were competing, but I know you probably reflected on it later and probably had some thoughts on what a wild week it was for you personally.
Yeah, it was super cool. And the fact that Herb was getting inducted that week, and there's so many former players of his, alumni, boosters, friends of his that that are all very close with the players and former players. Like, it's a, definitely a family. Herb's been there, or was there, for 40 years, and he's always been close with his former players. And so it was, I mean, there's a ton of people, and I wanted to make sure that I was there for a lot of the ceremonies and stuff like that. And actually had John Mills, who ended up caddying for me too. He was a busy man that week with attending everything and then coming out on the golf course with me. And obviously I have Corey Connors and Mackenzie Hughes there as well. Ryan Yip was playing too, and sure enough, you guys were out there, Herb out there on the golf course, walking with us, watching us play a little bit. And I remember my parents, it was during my first round, he came out and watched first few holes, and he was walking with his wife, Paula, and he's just motoring up the up the cart path and not really being social with people and watching. And Paula said, you know, you can take the coach out of the game, but you can't take the coach out of him.
Yeah. I thought it was actually obviously one of the coolest weeks for me as well. You know, first time I was out there caddying, but I still touch on one of my favorite moments of the week was the Tuesday practice round when you know, Derek said, "Hey, come with us, boys." And we walked the entire back nine with you guys and just watched, you know, how you all prepared for that. Which, you know, even at that point, it was amazing just seeing what was going to happen that week. You know, you were on the golf course for 2 days at that point, but at what point did the nerves go away in the sense of like, okay, I'm out here to play. I'm not just hitting golf balls beside Dustin Johnson and just like, I actually belong here.
Yeah. There's definitely some cool moments. I remember being on the putting green and some of the guys, like, I was putting to the same hole as Sergio, who's someone I've grown up watching a lot. I was kind of just like, oh, holy cow, it's Sergio right there. You better make this. And then, I was pretty nervous, like, the whole week and, like, even, like, practice round, stuff like that. Like, you just kind of not comfortable. And then it was funny, I got there, like, Thursday morning or Thursday to play, and was once they got to like the driving range and was warming up, stuff like that, felt fairly normal. Walking over the first tee, like, felt, I was just kind of like normal first tee jitters. Like, even when I was standing there ready to hit, called my name, fine, pre-shot routine, stood over the golf ball and was shaking. I was like, oh my gosh. And the thing was, it was a 3-wood, and like, you're hoping that if when you're super nervous that maybe you could hit a driver and you got a little bit bigger club face. But I was just think just get it airborne, and actually smoked it and hit a pretty good shot, so I was happy.
Well, I've seen Scotty pull 3-wood on first tees many a times, and it usually doesn't go well. It's not usually airborne at that point, so I'm glad you got it airborne.
Yeah.
You've obviously played a lot of golf with guys like Corey Connors, Mackenzie Hughes, Taylor Pendrith. Now that you're, you know, a professional golfer, just like them, are you still comparing your game to them and those experiences and seeing, you know, what you need to work on to get to their level?
Yeah, I think you see, I haven't played too much golf with Mackenzie. I've played with him once or twice, but, I haven't played with Corey in a while, but he's just so consistent in his ball striking. And, you know, his misses are very, very small, and the way that he thinks around the golf course is very good too. So definitely look up to those guys, and they're awesome for answering any questions and stuff like that too. But it's funny, all three of them probably have quite a bit different game, so it'd be nice to try to get a little bit from each of them.
So, I mean, for you now, you're making the adjustment from, you know, national team, college coaches or college teams, and now basically you're your own team. I mean, you can obviously put people around you, but it's on you. Could you really explain to people maybe what it feels like, or what are the changes for you to go from a team environment to all of a sudden a solo environment? Because, you know, obviously coming up as a junior golfer and whatever, you're sort of playing for yourself, then you sort of get in that team mode, now you're back to solo again and for your living.
Yeah, I feel like the national team really helped me prepare for that. As much as it is a team environment, like you travel to some tournaments and you're still on your own. You're there by yourself preparing for the event, traveling place to place. Like the couple of the trips that I did going to Australia, flying over there, being there for a month, playing four straight weeks, doing all the, you know, figuring out all your flights and rental car and hotel and stuff like that. So I feel like the national team really prepared me, for that too. So transitioning into professional golf and having to do all those little things yourself doesn't feel that new. I know if you go kind of straight from college golf to playing professional golf, where you got you got your coach who's driving the rental cars and meals paid for and don't have to think about that at all, and get to the hotel and you're just given a room key and don't have to give a credit card for any information, little things like that. So as I said, with the national team, it is a team environment and you are with Derek a lot, but you're also kind of on your own quite a bit, traveling and playing events, and that helped me kind of transition, and it honestly hasn't felt too much different really.
Well, I think the one thing you touched on is, you know, you actually have to spend money to do these things, right? Somebody else isn't doing it for you. And, you know, this is where we overlapped a little bit, in the sense we actually worked together for a short period of time before you were going to down to Florida to start your professional career, which is, you know, one way to make money, but it's tough right now. So like, obviously you're not playing right now. There's no events really going on. Are you just trying to find ways to make money, odd jobs and things, just so you can keep that dream alive once it does open back up?
Yeah, actually, I can be working with the grounds crew tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock at Loyalist. Would be my first day. So, I mean, honestly, at the moment, just trying to find a little bit of a way to make some cash. There's not going to be a ton to play in right away. I mean, maybe later this summer there might be some stuff to get into, but at the moment, yeah, just trying to make a few bucks and still work on the game quite a bit.
Well, you mentioned our golf course that we both play out at Loyalist Golf and Country Club. So you and I haven't had a chance to play together yet, but I just want to know, right? Say you and I go out and play. I'm a 4.5, probably a vanity handicap at that. 4.5 handicap. How many strokes do you think you have to give me to make it a fair match?
What season will we be playing?
Oh, we'll play it's not long back there. We'll play the backs.
Yeah. I don't know, maybe 10-ish.
Yeah, but like, I think that I just want to put that into perspective for people, right? Like, you have to, like, and again, I might even just say it probably is a vanity cap for myself at 4.5, but we're going to bypass that.
Smoked.
Yeah, no, but I just want to put that in perspective for people is that, like, I need 10 from you. A guy, also 10's probably generous considering you shot 7 under on the back nine the other day there, but I'm not getting into that. I need 10 just to be even close. I'm still going to get smoked. This isn't a chirp against you. And this guy has zero status on any professional tour right now. Like,
yeah, there's a lot of good players out there who in a similar situation as myself, for sure.
Yeah, but it just puts it in perspective, like, how hard professional golf is.
See, Stefan, you have to take him on when Josh is only 16. Then you have a chance.
I figured that was going to be.
I'm not going to bring it up, but that's about the only time, because after that, I'm never playing him again.
What's the story here? Did you beat him when he was 16?
I'll let Josh.
So we played. It was like intersectional matches. It was what, Glenn Lawrence, right?
Yeah, it was Glenn Lawrence.
And so the final group was myself, Austin James, and Scott McLeod. And I think, I don't know what hole he ended up beating me on, but
18.
Yeah, I know Austin had himself a pretty good day.
Austin was 4 under after 3. I think he shook all our hands on like 15 or something.
Yeah. And then, so it was, I don't try not to remember that one too much, but I'm sure Scott does.
Now, Josh, you didn't have to tell that story because, for all intents and purposes, that golf course doesn't even exist. That history is gone. There's no proof of any of that. No, you didn't have to tell that.
No room for a rematch for myself.
Exactly.
No, I'm smart. I said to your buddy Daz, I'm like, I'm never going to play him again because at least I can always say I've got that. So, and I'm not going to go near it. The cool part was, though, that Josh had won the Ontario Juvenile Championship 2 weeks before, right? Shot 64 in the final round, 29 on the front nine. I do an interview with him, and 2 weeks later, I have to play him. How fun is that?
Well, hopefully I get to play him this week. I'll report back next week about how the 10 strokes went. I don't think
I want to hear this.
But, you know, we talk about, you know, making money and stuff like that. What else are you doing to just kind of keep the dream alive? Obviously, this is probably throwing a new wrench in there. You know, how are you just focusing on staying positive? I've said to Derek many a times, like, if any time I go to the range, you're out there working and, you know, clearly a hard worker. I don't think anyone would dispute that. But what else are you doing just to keep it going and know, like, hey, this can happen. I believe in myself.
Yeah. The one thing for me, like, I've always just really enjoyed playing. Like, I know there's some people who, you know, really they work hard, spend a lot of time on the range, putting green, whatever. But they, you know, they don't play. Like, I love to try to play 18 holes every day, at least. I mean, and during this time, like, not in there, you know, the range is only there for a warm up and not really supposed to be hanging around too much. So I think I've played every day except one since golf course has been open here in Ontario, and a couple days of 36 and most days end up playing 27. So I've just been out on the golf course a ton and just kind of playing and doing my practicing out there. And that's where I enjoy to be. So hasn't felt too weird that way, but not having something to prepare for is what is kind of difficult. Like, the times that I have spent a little bit of time hitting balls and you're not like, you're like, why am I here? But it's just like, I don't have anything that I'm preparing for at the moment, which is what I miss. Like, when I was down in Florida, you had a tournament to prepare for, and long term there was Canadian Tour Q School and stuff like that. So at the moment I just focused on trying to get better, obviously. And I think I'm kind of like addicted to that and to trying to always get better. And so I still going to be out there playing and practicing and stuff like that, and hopefully have something to maybe compete in later this summer. But yeah, maybe I'll have to find some matches with Stefan to keep my
the match three, the one that all will be talking about.
Yeah. So one other thing here is, you know, as you've turned pro, I mean, you're not even, you know, you haven't even turned pro for a year now. Haven't really got, you know, a full schedule in per se, but how much do you project ahead and think about, you know, your timeline? I mean, do you put a timeline on it for yourself as far as goals and where you have to be at a certain point? Or, you know, do you say, this is, I just play out the pro career, or I have to be at a certain level at a certain time?
Yeah, I think you kind of have to come up with a plan. You can't just sort of fly by the seat of your pants. So, I mean, this is obviously changed things quite a bit, but definitely looking like long term, and trying to, you know, get to, you know, start. I mean, unfortunately haven't really had a chance to start out, but yeah, just trying to get up, to keep trying to move up. And I feel like myself, I've steadily progressed at each and every level, so just kind of want to see progression in the next couple years. But yeah, definitely want to try to fulfill the dream. But I don't see myself as being someone who's hanging around trying to chase a great dream till I'm 35 years old. I love the game of golf, and if professional golf weren't to work out, then I'd love to share that passion with other people.
Well, I can tell you this, one thing that will be growing is your wallet after we play. I know that for a fact. Josh, we really do appreciate you coming on Tee Talk. We're looking forward to following your career. Obviously, we hope it gets started sooner rather than later here, and that we can wrap it up. And there are some tournaments available to you. We know you got the game, and hopefully you got a place to play soon.
Thanks for having me, guys. I would love to come back on some other time.
Thank you, Josh, for joining us on the Tee Talk podcast. Great guy. Looking forward to getting absolutely smoked by him when I give him 10 strokes. Like, I mean, I'm putting every score in this year, and my cap's not going down. So is it a vanity cap? I don't know. I joke about it, but it might be. It might be, Scott.
Well, in a match, who knows? You might be okay. There might be some weak stroke holes or whatever, but you're going to have to be on your game. Let's just say that, because he's going to throw so many birdies at you that your head is going to spin.
If he birdies, so like the golf course we play at, like one and two are very easy holes. Two is a par three, and it's easy still. If he birdies three, I know I'm bogeying it. I do it every time. So like that's going to be devastating. And then we're going to go into, I'm going to be done. I'm just done. I don't even know why I'm going through. I'm going through every hole and I'm done. I don't know. I need 18. I think I actually need 18.
Well, I'll tell you this, that final of the year, he won the Ontario Juvenile Championship there. The assistant coach for Kent State at that point was there to recruit him. He shoots 29 on the front nine in the final round. He looks over at me and he's like, eh, that's enough. And he's gone. Didn't even watch the back nine. He knew he wanted this kid. He's just that capable. You know, he's got a lot of firepower. It's been fun to watch him grow up and turn into the player that he has, you know, get a college win, be at Kent State. Certainly he's got all the tools to be successful as a pro, and you'll see that when you get to take him on.
Yeah, I'll report back next week and let you know how it goes. Speaking of reporting back, what were you hearing about role play last week? I thought we did a really good job getting a lot of feedback.
Well, I hear my acting was really good, and maybe they weren't in love with your method feedback or your method acting. I don't know.
Is that your wife that told you that?
Probably, yeah.
So not a lot of feedback. Okay, well.
Not a lot. So
we should come up with some new games. I was just thinking we were just going to play role play again, but if we're not getting a lot of feedback, what else do you have for us?
How about two truths and a lie? What do you think of that?
Okay, so give me the premise. Let me hear.
Here's the premise. I'm going to give you the name of a player, tour player. I'm going to give you three things about them.
Okay.
Two of them are true. One of them is a lie. You've got to pick out the lie.
All right.
So
you got this prepared right now?
I do. I'm prepped, man. I'm already ready to go. I'm always prepared.
You're a professional.
I try. All right, let's start with Shane Lowry. So here's my your boy. Three things. Your boy, Shane Lowry. I knew you loved this guy, so I figured, you know what? Let's talk Shane Lowry here. All right, here's the three things. Wait till I say the three, and then you can tell me which one you think is a lie. One, was a scratch player after 3 years of playing. Two, was a competitive rugby player. Three, has only finished in the top 100 of the FedEx Cup once.
Ooh, okay. Okay, one was a scratch player after three. That's impressive. That's real tough to do. Okay, number two, he was a competitive rugby player. See, now that one pops out, but this guy's a unit, so doesn't he could he his body could handle it, and then has only finished the top 100 of the FedEx Cup once. He plays a lot overseas, so I'm going with number one. I feel like it's going to be 4 years of play. 4 years.
Yeah, it took him a little bit more than that. Within a couple of years, he was down to a 12, then took him, I think, 5 years or so to get to a single digit. So it took him a little bit longer than that. But yeah, you're right. He's only finished once in the top 100 of the FedEx Cup, and that's just because he's played a lot in Europe. I thought that might trick you there, but good job. You're one for one.
Hey, there we go.
All right, next one, Jack Nicklaus. So obviously not your era, but I figure I'd test you anyways and see what you've got to say about this one. So here we go. How good are you on your Jack Nicklaus trivia?
He won the 1986 Masters.
That's it? His whole career? That's it.
I know that right. One. 18 majors. If there's an 18 majors, that's a true.
Yeah, it's not going to be in this one. All right, here we go. His first PGA Tour check was $33.33. He has his own ice cream brand. He has designed golf courses in over 65 countries.
Okay. So now we're down to two. I know he has his own ice cream brand. I know he has his own ice cream
brand. Okay. How do you know that? You've eaten it?
I mean, they talk about it. Anytime they go to the memorial, it's like all about it. So that one, now what you're doing is you've created two where it's like I could flub one number here. And it could mean nothing. 65 countries is a lot of countries to design golf courses in. 33. Big check. That's probably worth like 100K now.
And the 200 Canadian.
Yeah, and the conversion rate. I'm going with three being a lie. Designed golf courses over 65 countries.
Wow, two for two. He's actually 45 countries, 425 courses. Yes, ice cream brand. He's got licenses on almost 250 products, I believe. And that first PGA Tour check, that was in 1962. That was the LA Open. And yeah, 33. So good job. Two for two.
All right.
Pretty good. I'm impressed so far. So one last player here. Let's see if you can get this one. John Rahm. Mm-hmm. All right. How's your John Rahm trivia?
ASU, know that for a fact.
Right, that's good.
Spanish.
Yeah.
He's a unit. That was my three.
Unit seems to be the word of the day. I guess you could probably
pick up on my trends of my favorite players.
Yeah, I do.
The out-of-shape guy that clearly likes, like, the Appy Barnrats, the Shane Lowrys, the John Rahms, like, the guy that's like, no, I'm not going to the gym. I'm going to Chick-fil-A.
Maybe that was my theme this week. You never know. I mean, to Chick-fil-A.
Jack wasn't fit by any means, so.
There you go. All right, here we go. You ready? All right, one has made $18 million in just 80 PGA Tour events. Practice Kung Fu, and his ace at the 2020 WGC Mexico Championship was the fifth of his PGA Tour career.
All right. Okay. I feel like he's almost made more than 18. So that's, I think that one's good. Practice Kung Fu. It seems so weird. It's got to be true, but he's had a ton of aces. Like wow, this is a tough one.
I didn't say it was going to be easy.
Yeah. Five? He's only, when did he get out of college? Like 2016? 2017? That's like, oh man. That's too many. I think that's too many. I'm thinking he has three aces on the PGA Tour. I'm going with three being the lie.
Oh, man, you are three for three. He's actually had two aces. Oh. Think about that. He's only played in 80 PGA Tour events, so 300 rounds on tour. But, yeah, he's made $18 million in 80 events. Kung Fu was one of his sports. He had a number of them that he played.
One of his sports.
Sports, we'll call it. Discipline, martial art, whatever the case may be. And then, his ace at the Mexico Championship was only the second of his PGA Tour career. Well done. Three for three. That's impressive.
That is impressive. So, I got to do this for you at some point, maybe next week. I thought of another cool game. Well, it's not really a game. Just like we're both just going to look up obscure former PGA Tour players that people will or might know the name of. And just like, where are they now? Like just going back in history. So if anyone has any people that they suggest that they want to know, and I know we all want to know where Anthony Kim is now. We're not going to find that out. Don't send in Anthony Kim, but anyone else, send it in. We'll do that next week. I think it'll be a fun little game as we also report on the match three next week too, where I just lose whatever amount of money that Josh asked for.
Is that the official match three, you against Josh Whalen?
Yeah, like we got HBO coming. It'll be sweet. It'll be airing on, we have HBO coming, but it'll be airing on the Weather Network.
YouTube at best, maybe yeah. Instagram Live.
CP24 might throw it on the bottom on the ticker, but that's about it. Well, why don't we hit the mailbag? But before we do, a quick message from our sponsors.
This episode of T-Talk is brought to you by the all-new Tour Response from TaylorMade. Golfers have been yelling at their balls since always. So TaylorMade decided to make a ball that's designed to maximize performance and minimize shouting with a soft, responsive urethane cover that's surprisingly affordable. So now, just like the pros, you can swear by a urethane ball, but without paying a tour quality price. The all-new Tour Response from TaylorMade. Swear by it, not at it. Visit TaylorMadeGolf.ca to learn more about the all-new Tour Response golf ball. We're back with the mailbag where we answer your questions, the ones that you send in via Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, any way that you can find us, fax, carrier pigeon, whatever it takes, send them in. We love getting your questions. So let's start with our first one this week. I want to introduce my dad to golf, but a lot of golf courses are really busy right now. Any ideas of what we can do so he can try the game where he won't feel a lot of pressure from other golfers? Thoughts on that one?
Yeah, no, I got a ton. First, sure. Absolutely bring him. It doesn't matter when. It's like any time's a good time. Now, if you know he'll be aware of people behind him and watching and things like that, A, make sure you go to the range first. I know it's not as fun probably, but make sure you've gotten a couple range sessions that he actually feels like I can hit the golf ball a little bit and that like maybe I do want to see what it's like to be on a course. And then maybe just do like a Twilight Nine. Go out late at night, like a 5 o'clock round, usually the least busy in a lot of senses, or you're going to have the people that are probably just playing by themselves and they're aware and they'll maybe play through you. But that's my guess. I always just say, yeah, go out late. My plan this week, she's gone to the range once. She wants to go back, but then we're probably going to go out and do kind of a Twilight Nine. So less pressure. I know that feeling, being that group where you're the guy in the middle of the fairway and the people are behind you and you're feeling pressured. Really, if my biggest thing is never worry about the people behind you. Just worry about the people in front of you. If you're close enough to them, then you're fine. That's it. But if that's the key, is just not having any pressure, then Twilight for me.
Yeah, Twilight's a good example, especially any of the busier courses. Other option as well, look at some of the other golf courses that are maybe not in an urban area. Look at maybe some of the nine-holers that are kind of in the country a little bit more or something. I mean, not far from here, there's a few golf courses that are 20, 30 minutes away. On occasion, I'll take my daughter out there. We'll play nine holes. Really not as busy. Again, you know, later in the afternoon, same thing. Not their busy times. Less pressure. There's a lot of beginners out there. then they can sort of take their time, get to know things, and feel free when you're out there, you know, explain some things to make them comfortable as well. You know, let them know where things are and, you know, what etiquette is like and what they should do and maybe what their expectations are. And then they're not going to have as much anxiety about playing. And, you know, you can show them too that, you know, if a group comes up, how to let another group play through, whatever the case may be. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, if you're the experienced golfer, just be the guide for them. But I agree, Twilight, or, you know, golf courses that are kind of maybe out of the town a little bit more, a little smaller golf course, it might have a better situation, give them less anxiety and let them enjoy the game more.
I like that answer.
All right. Here's a short question, but a good one. Hard six or a soft five preference?
Well, it is a short question, if you know what I
mean. It is.
And an interesting question for, this is a golf question, right?
I think so.
You sure?
I'm hoping.
Was this a personal question to your Twitter account?
No.
Your own? Okay, just want to confirm that. I can't get past that point. So, from a caddy perspective, whether you believe I'm one or not, I don't know if you do. There's so much to take into consideration here. I still can't get past the question.
I'm losing it. can we not be playing a short par three instead or something? Seriously.
Oh, it's a three.
This might just be a joke on us. There's, who knows?
There's three of you now. Oh, no, par three, right.
Par three. Yeah.
Because if there's three, you want a hard
six. Don't even go there.
okay. is seven an option? maybe a hybrid. So let's go over some situations. There's so much info you need. Where's the wind coming from? Is it front, back? Is it off the side? There's so much info. For me though, like if it's just a general, are you either gonna rip a six or you're hitting a soft five? Give me the soft five. Generally speaking, long's better than short most of the time, in my opinion. Soft five imbalance, you're probably not gonna. Yeah, stop laughing, man. Yeah. For me, this might be our first viral clip.
This might be the funniest question
and
of
we
all
Gary
time
Player
that we didn't
that,
think yeah, about.
This might be our first viral clip, and we had Gary Player say Jack Nicklaus had the coronavirus. So for me, it's a soft five.
All right.
Just ask around. You'll find out that's the truth. Go ahead.
You know what? I'm not touching that. I'm just going to agree with you.
You're not touching my soft five.
No, I'm not going near it. Flighted shot, in balance, hit it solid. Don't go crazy. Next question. All right. And if you were the person that sent in that question and it was meant to be a joke on us.
No, if you're the person that sent that question in, you can write our whole mailbag from here on out. You write every question. I don't know who you were, but that was great.
All right. I'm looking at buying new wedges. Anything I should be looking for? I've never bought new ones before.
Oh, man. This is a good one. But again, it's just like everything. Just go get fit. A wedge fitting is something so important. You got to pay attention. There's so much to know about wedges. You got to pay attention to the bounce. You got to pay attention to the lie angle. You got to pay attention to the actual gapping between wedges. A lot of people just go in and be like, okay, I need a 60. Okay, I have a gap wedge. Okay, then I need a 56. Your pitching wedge might be 44 degrees, right? So who knows? Yeah. Who knows what that means? So the key here, absolutely get fit. Pay attention to, you know, make sure you're aware of your golf course conditions, right? Let the fitter know that. Like, I play on a really soft golf course. I play on a really hard golf course. There's so much to know, but you definitely need to get fit. If you want me to summarize it up very quickly and you don't have the opportunity to get fit because it's not necessarily an option right now, you do want your wedges. Like, this is just very, very minimal, like, learning and fitting. You want your wedges a little bit flatter than your irons. So if your irons are, say, 2 degrees upright, go at least one below. That's 1 degree. I would recommend two just so you can really pull on them. If you're playing on a super soft course, you want low bounce. You want to get out of that grass as soon as possible. Am I right here?
No, more bounce.
Sorry, more bounce. Yeah.
Yeah, you got to work it out of the turf, dig into it.
Yeah, you want to get out of the grass, so more bounce. I knew it didn't sound right. And then the opposite. Yeah. If it's very hard, you want less bounce. You want to get into that grass. And then generally speaking, for me, I always recommend like a full wedge for your gap wedge. You're probably not going to be opening up the face a lot on a gap wedge, so just kind of a full wedge. And then on your sand wedge and your lob wedge, there's a lot of preference in there, and that's where things get tricky of the right grind.
Yeah, there's a lot of good advice there. As you said, it's not as simple as most people think, and it's a pretty critical thing in your bag, because these are your scoring clubs. They're the ones that you're going to use the most, especially when you're sub, 100 yards. They definitely need to be effective. They're tools, and that's what people have to think about. I think a lot of people look at them as, fashion accessories. They want to, they're worried about the color and the stamping and whatever, but these are tools. That's what they are. They're designed to basically give you the right yardage, the right turf interaction. Use, like you said, be useful at the course that you play, the conditions that you play, the shots that you play, your style of swing as well. So don't neglect getting fit for them. Go through the process. If you have a chance to demo them as well outside, then you're going to see the turf interaction there as well, and that makes a big difference.
I also missed, like, divot size comes into play. Like, I didn't even talk about divot size. Like, so clearly, like, I'm talking about, you want to make sure your swing, right? You want to make sure the course. You want to make sure your divot. There's so much to consider. Please, if I could even just make people get fit for one thing, it's probably wedges the most, because there's just so much variance in it.
Yeah, really, really, really is. And I mean, if we look, we'll say for the better player, sub 120 yards, if you've got, four or five clubs to make use of there, and you're going to be using them for a large percent of your shots, you definitely need to put some investment in them as well. So, take your time with it. Be as thorough as possible. Don't just jump in and grab three wedges just because they look cool. Dump them in your bag and expect they're going to work very well. All right, on to the next one. Another equipment question as well. I'm trying to cut down my ball flight by a third. I don't know how high this person hits this golf ball, but a third is significant, obviously. I hit it really high. Would a ball model change help?
I wish I could reopen the mailbag for this person. Do you actually hit it high?
That's the question, because a lot of people, you're right, they look up and they say, oh, I hit it really, really high. And then you go out and you see them, and let's say a tour player hitting a driver at 120 feet, right? Let's say they're averaging close to 100 feet with most of their irons. That will look like it's a balloon ball. You go with a lot of amateurs and they say they hit the ball too high, and you go out and you see them, they hit it 60 feet off the ground.
Yeah.
They think that's too high and that the wind is going to hit it and kill it. So you're right. I mean, this is a high is a perspective as far as the word. You really got to understand how high is it and is it too high?
Yeah. So I stood next to Rory McIlroy on the range and watched him at four irons that were like higher than my driver, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, I hit it low compared to them, if we're looking at it in the way of just the ball flight, right? Mm-hmm. Swing speed comes into play. So again, we there's a reason we keep hammering this into your heads. Go get fit, get on a TrackMan, get on a Foresight, get on something with a professional fitter or coach, and let them tell you if you hit it too high. And we've even told stories about Brad Fritch on here where he literally was giving up 20 yards from his driver just because he didn't want to hit that high. Again, it doesn't matter if it's high, because it's the right ball flight, the right launch, the right descent angle, the right spin, then that's what your ball flight should go based on your swing. There's so many factors to take into account. Please do not just bring down your ball flight just because you think you hit it high.
Definitely. And how much a golf ball can change it. It can do it a little bit, but not as much as probably things like dynamic loft and what you're presenting that way. If this is a person, for an example, that does hit it super, super high, it could be a situation where their clubs are have issues, yeah, and not necessarily the golf ball. And you know what? We also have to consider golf ball models as far as spin rates. There's a lot of things that, complicate this question. So it's not as easy as us just saying, hey, you know what, just change the ball model and it'll be magic. So yeah, you definitely have to go through a process and work with a qualified fitter with the diagnostic tools to be able to measure that and see where things are at relative to what your game is. Okay, two here. Actually, this one is pretty much relative to our guest this week. How do developing pro golfers make money support themselves? I think we already answered that in the podcast if you listened to the Josh Whalen interview.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's obvious. I've worked for Golf Town in the past. I've worked with many local pros that have come through just trying to make a few bucks to make it work. I've worked with pro caddies that come through. You know, Josh talked about it. He's working as on the grounds crew.
On the grounds crew,
now,
yeah.
The course we play at. We talked about David Byrne earlier. He you know,
the bartender
slings
at a
drinks.
Sushi restaurant.
Yeah,
at a
sushi restaurant. Getting the sake to people. You know, like, they just have to do whatever is best for them and what makes the best use of their skills and something they can, you know, at least accept for a little bit, right? Like, everyone's different. Some people have more backing than others. Mm-hmm. I've never been a professional golfer. You dabbled in it a little bit. How did you make money to try to make that run of things?
Well, the thing is, I only played a few mini tour events and things, so it's basically just cash that came out of my own pocket. But I've been involved with helping other pro golfers put things together. And I mean, you know, they would sell shares in themselves. You know, every year they'd be going and finding, for an example, a player that would be playing a full circuit on the Canadian tour, maybe Hooters tour in the winter, and then going to PGA Tour Q School and European Tour Q School. They'd have to find $60,000 or $70,000 a year to support that. So they would do that. Like I said, they might be doing some corporate gigs. They might find something that paid a little bit of money that they could go do some events. They might find an angel, which was always what a lot of them were after. If they could find somebody that just had a big check in their pocket and was, you know, really wanting to support a tour player. And you've got to understand, too, a lot of the times when people are buying shares in players, they look at it as a donation to help somebody from the community. There's fundraising tournaments. There's all sorts of things. But in the end, it comes down to the golfer and how determined they are. And the ones that generally do the best are the ones that really just don't sit there and take money from everyone. They do exactly what you said. They go and they grind. They do everything possible to make their dreams come true. They're not afraid to say, you know what, I might have to go wait tables. I might have to go work in the movie theater. Whatever it takes, if that's their dream, they're going to have to do that. Chances are there's just not a lot of free money hanging out around for them. This is not a Ricky Fowler or Jordan Spieth where all of a sudden, you know, corporations are going to be throwing cash at you right away. You're going to have to do a lot of dirty work to get to the glory.
That's the key. It's not easy to make it there. Only the few do. And, you know, how you get there, it's different for everyone. So if that's something that you're thinking about doing, then we wish you luck. And hopefully you're able to find ways to keep the dream alive. So we're going to mix things up. The last one actually came directly to me this week. There's a little bit of a situation going on at this golf course in Southern Ontario. And they just said, I want you to bring it up on the podcast. And basically what the situation I have is they got their usual kind of, there's about 6 to 8 of them that play at this club and they're all good buddies outside of the course. So very good buddies. But the one buddy out there on the course, they never really play for money. That's something you should know. But, this guy's always cheating and he's cheating like in the obvious way that like, everyone knows it's the ball dropper, the guy that blasts it on the 401.
And then look, I found it.
Yeah. And then look, I found it over here. And it's just like, so the question was, how do I do? Like, what do I do? How do I address this? So am I going to let you go first and then I'll give some thoughts.
Well, I guess it's gotta be respective of the situation. You said they don't play for money.
They don't play for money, but this guy will like, he'll chirp a bit if he beats you.
Yeah, so he's the guy that all of a sudden he says, I shot 78, but you know he shot 92.
Yeah, it's probably at least 10 strokes higher than whatever he said.
Yeah, I think even if you are friends, you got to explain to this person that the only person they're cheating is themselves as far as their ability to play the game. And you've got to make them aware that you're aware of what they're doing, that they're not getting away with it. I think in most cases, you know, I've seen it, you know, junior golf and stuff like that. They think they're getting away with it. You know, and not just junior, I shouldn't just say junior golf, but I've seen that situation in junior golf, even when I was in junior golf. If they think they're getting away with it, they'll keep doing it. But if they get called out on it, they're going to be a lot more aware. So, you know, as tough as it can be, even though it's a friend, you've still got to say, hey, you know what? If you're going to talk to me about, you know, beating me, we got to be playing by the same rules. Right. And that's really what it comes down to. So, you know, again, this could get really complicated if it's for money. That's a whole other bucket to deal with here. But really, just make them aware that, you know what, don't chirp me. Do whatever you want. If you want to go out and play and you want to drop balls and whatever, But one, don't be putting that score in for your handicap. And two, don't be using it to compare to others unless you're on the same footing. You know, don't compare apples to oranges.
One, I'm going to disagree with you on one thing. Put that score in for your handicap, because when we actually play for money, I'm going to make a ton off you.
Well, yeah. See, but there's what I said about them only cheating themselves, right?
Yeah, exactly.
They think they're going to get away with it. It's the guy who, you know, picks up every putt from 5 feet. Then he gets into the tournament and he's like, oh man, I can't make a 5-footer. Yeah. Well, guess what? You've never had to make one.
Yeah, I get it with that. Like, I'm fine with being a little bit more liberal on your drops, or saying, you know, like, we're not going to play that OB. You know, we're going to play it as a hazard today. Yeah. Whatever. I'm fine
with
that.
If you're all doing it.
Yeah, if everyone's doing it, it's fine. The guy that does the ball in the pocket trick thinks he's a genius. Everyone saw you start it 50 yards right of the fairway, and it was only going right. It's the most obvious cheating thing of all time. So it actually brings me back to, I saw this cool article from like the 90s today in Golf Digest, that they kind of like go back into your, you know, into the archive or whatever. And it was literally about the cheaters on tour. And I think the article is literally just called, "We All Know Who They Are." If you're that guy in the group, you think you're getting away with it, every single one in your group knows exactly who you are. They're all talking about you behind your back. You might be good buddies off the golf course, but they do not want to golf with you. Because
I think we've talked about it on the podcast before, of a situation at a Canadian tour event where a player, you know, by a miracle, was finding his golf ball around the corner. And it was actually a spectator who called him on it and basically said, "Hey, I just saw you drop that ball," or whatever. And it probably took about 5 minutes to get through the clubhouse and get to all the players. And then, you know, he obviously had to admit it and got DQ'd out of the event. And, you know, that guy's labeled forever. It doesn't really
matter. They never go away. And that's what they touched on there in that article. Those things never go away. Patrick Reed is never going to go away for his cheating stuff. It's around forever. Golf is a game about integrity.
Yeah. And the odd part was that player who was playing of the PGA Tour, the McKenzie Tour. I'm going to say that incident probably happened in 2013 or 14. And then 1 year, about 2 years ago, so it would have been 4 or 5 years later, I was on the driving range at a golf course in Las Vegas talking to a pro there who happened to be a Canadian. And he was waiting for his student. And lo and behold, guess who his student was? Wow. Was that touring pro. Here's 5 years later. And he says, "Hey, do you know Boo?" And I turned and looked at him. I'm like, "Oh, I do." Yeah. And he looked at me and he knew right away. You know, you could tell by the look on his face. So, you know, that's going to live with him for a long, long time. Deservedly so.
Yeah. But it never goes away. And that's the key here. So what... one fun thing in that article, they said, I forget who said it, but he said on the first tee, he had a friend in his group that he knew was cheering. He said, he always would say, "I don't know what game you guys are playing today, but boys, but I'll be playing golf." And what I suggest is you look right at that guy in your group and you say, "I don't know what game you're playing there, Johnny, but I'm playing golf today. And if you want to play golf with me, we'll play golf. But if you don't want to play golf, you play whatever game you're playing. I don't care."
You got it.
And it doesn't really matter. At the end of the day, friendships are probably more important if they actually are a good friend. But just, I think if I were you, I'd call him out on it every single time on the golf course. Every single day. Just beat it out of him to the point where he like realizes, like, you know, you can only, like, you know, if everyone's calling you out on it over and over and over and over every single round, maybe it's you.
I think they'll find out in the end too, that, you know, the acceptance of the bad shot is just, it's just part of the game, you know, and it's not going to destroy them. They just got to realize that, you know, take your penalty and move on. And then you're all on the same ground and you can all have a great time.
I agree. Well, speaking of bad shots, we usually have tips to fix bad shots.
We do.
Scotty, why don't you give us the tip of the week?
All right. Going to talk a little putting today. A lot of people, I'm hearing from a lot of people, are struggling with speed and their putting, especially early in the year. One thing I like to say to people is, first off, be really patient. I mean, here's the thing. You've been inside, you know, you haven't been playing golf. The longest putt you've probably had to make is 12 feet on your putting mat. So for a lot of people, a lot less than that. So you have not been working on your speed. So, you know, definitely be patient to start with. And I think the first thing for people to look at, though, is not just to run to the putting green and start to stroke 5 foot putts and so forth and think, okay, that's going to help me out. There's a couple of things that you need to do. First thing, you know, go see your coach or find a coach talk to them a little bit about your technique, because technique will affect your speed variation by a lot. I've seen some players just in the last couple of weeks or so that had issues with how much loft they were having on their putter. They basically would add some or take some off, have the face open or closed, which again affects the loft, which affects the ball speed. Other people as well, that their setup would affect where they're making contact on the face with the ball, which again affects ball speed. And, you know, they might make adjustments between strokes of where they hit it, and then they're all messed up. They're really not tuned in that way. So talk to your coach about your mechanics, make sure they're stable that way. Then what you're going to have to do is go to the putting green and look at doing some speed drills. So again, not going and banging these 5-footers towards a hole, focus solely on speed, not so much of a target. A really good drill for to do that is, you know, a leapfrog type drill, where you're basically going to start at a single point. You're going to putt a ball to, say, you know, 10 to 15 feet. And then what you're going to do is the next putt, you're going to try to maybe stop the ball within 6 inches past that. And basically you're going to work on that control so that you can control that speed and really develop those micro skills so that you can get that feel for what you're doing. And you know what? You're not going to get better with the speed and feel if you don't practice it. So check your mechanics, do some speed drills. You'll be better, and be patient. Before you know it, you'll have some experience. Your body will know what signals to send your muscles to be able to try different speeds when you're putting. And before you know it, you know, you'll be much better, and, you know, maybe eliminate some of those three putts.
That's actually a really good tip. And I like the actual drill you gave there as well. And one thing just to be, you know, aware of is the greens, if you're probably playing in Canada, that is, they're not perfect yet. And, you know, if you're going into a golf course, you know, what you say you went Sunday and now you go there Monday and you didn't practice prior. Well, you know, you're going to learn something, and the greens aren't the same. They're going to get rolled. They're going to start get cut a little bit quicker. They're going to be smoother and smoother as the year goes on. So a lot to take into consideration here. But I love that drill. Write it down, go to the practice green and get working on it.
I agree. And I think the other thing too is, you know, a lot of the golf courses are only allowing the golfers, you know, a few minutes on the green before they get to the tee at this point. So, you know, it's a lot harder to get the feel for that. So again, be patient, but, you know, use that time wisely when you're there. Do an actual drill. Just don't bang a ball towards the hole. It's not going to make you any better.
Yeah. The whole, like, I'm a field golfer, it's not actually real. You don't go practice.
No.
Well, that's it for the week. Thank you to Josh Whalen for joining us and telling us his story. Really appreciate it. We're looking forward to hopefully his return to professional golf with the Mackenzie Tour whenever it comes, or whatever tour comes up in the future. So we do appreciate him coming on. We appreciate all your questions in the mailbag. We appreciate you subscribing to the podcast, and we appreciate you rating us 5 stars. And most importantly, we appreciate everyone voicing their concerns about the injustices that are happening all over the world and in the golf industry still. And again, we just recommend you look at yourself in the mirror. I know you and I have done that over the last couple of days, and you know, it's not, I didn't like what I saw looking back when I thought about everything in my life. And if I even think about golf, same thing. And this is important. We're a golf podcast, but at the end of the day, it's really not important. It's a game. These are people's lives we're talking about. People that should have equal opportunities just like you and I do. People that should be able to have a golf podcast just like you and I do. People that should be able to go home after, you know, a jog. Things like that. And as I said, just think about it. Take some time. It's not easy. And it shouldn't be easy. It's a tough thing to talk about. I'm running out of words because I don't know what to say other than, you know, we all need to be better. It starts with looking at yourself, and we're going to be doing that. So we appreciate everyone voicing their thoughts. We appreciate everyone protesting, and we think hopefully we become better because of this. So we'll leave it at that. Thank you to our sponsors. Thank you to everyone listening. We will be back next week. Just yesterday, but in
into slow motion. In a day like today, my boat is lost in the ocean.